Our series, the doctor and writer Ben Goldacre investigates the placebo effect.
Placebos can be ointments, they can be capsules, they can be surgery. There are trials in which they just open the patient up, close them up again, and don't do the surgical intervention. And that's in order to find out whether the real surgery is doing anything beyond the placebo effect.
The nicer you are to your patients and the more optimistic you are about their treatment, the more likely they are to get some kind of benefit.
It's not just handing a pill like you're throwing feed to a chicken in a chicken coop, but it's actually the pill, the medication, is part of an elaborate drama, and that drama has an impact on people's illness and health.
I think the attitude of most people is, I don't care what it is or how it works. If it makes me feel better, bring it on.
This is a program filled with improbable results, and in many respects, the placebo effect should be an outrage to science and medicine. We flatter ourselves that treatments are specific to the diseases that we're treating, that it's all about molecules, and then suddenly along comes a placebo pill with no ingredients, no actual medicine, that seems to work, relieve pain, improve mood, even treat Parkinson's disease, inducing changes in the brain. I'm Ben Goldacre, and over the next two programmes I'll be exploring the idea that beliefs and expectations can affect our health and well-being. And I'll also be considering the implications of this for doctors and for medicine as a whole. But we'll begin in the 18th century with a doctor from Connecticut. Elisha Perkins was a genius, or at least a very wealthy man, selling thin metal rods which he called Perkins tractors, a miraculous device that you waved over bits of the body to cure gout, rheumatism and all kinds of other ailments. They worked, he claimed, by drawing off the noxious electrical fluid that lies at the root of all suffering. And there were lavishly printed pamphlets promoting these Perkins tractors, filled with testimonials from satisfied customers.
Sir, a neighbour of mine, Mr. James Connor, was sorely afflicted with an inflammation in his left eye. The eye appeared like a ball of blood, and all the contiguous parts were much inflamed and of a bloody colour. I saw your metallic tractors applied to the affected part with such success that in the space of about 10 minutes he declared the pains were gone. He has told me since he never felt any inconvenience from it afterwards. Reverend Stephen B. Balch, Georgetown, May 16th, 1797.
News of these miraculous Perkins tractors spread rapidly around the world, and it wasn't long before someone decided to look into them. This was the Age of Enlightenment, and British physician John Haygarth was very much a man of his time, one of the first doctors to think methodically about collecting evidence for the things that doctors do, rather than simply relying on received wisdom. He proposed a carefully controlled test of the Perkins tractors to see whether or not they worked as claimed.
Prepare a pair of false, exactly to resemble the true tractors. Let the secret be kept inviolable, not only from the patient, but every other person. Let the efficacy of both be impartially tried. The cases should be accurately stated, and the reports of the effects produced by the true and false tractors be fully given, in the words of the patients.
Brilliantly, for the early 19th century, Haygarth is describing an example of what we'd now call a placebo-controlled blinded trial. It was controlled because there was a treatment group getting the real tractors and a comparison group getting something, placebo fake Perkins tractors, which was apparently the same thing, but missing the crucial, magic, noxious electrical fluid-sucking element. This is important, because there are lots of reasons why you might get better during any medical treatment, which often have nothing to do with the treatment itself. For one thing, all diseases have a natural history of their own, so people do just get better from colds or a gammy knee. Your back pain comes and goes, and so on. But Haygarth's test was also blinded. The fake and real treatments looked identical, and so the patients had no way of knowing which they were getting. The results of one trial, using fake wooden tractors on a man unable to control his bladder, were reported by one of Haygarth's colleagues, Mr. Richard Smith, at the Bristol Infirmary.
The man was a poor, feeble subject who was willing to try anything. In 1 minute, after the points of the wooden tractors had been drawn in various directions about the pelvis, he said, "I begin to feel something jumping in my inside." Later he reported that he felt a smarting in his loins, and upon sitting down exclaimed, "I am better." It was demanded how he knew it. "When I used to sit down," said the man, "there was always a spirit of water thrown from me. But now I can prevent it."
In a series of trials, Haygarth had answered his question. These miraculous recoveries had nothing to do with Perkins' patented product. But rather than leave a vacuum, Haygarth was keen to think through what else might explain these patients getting better.
"I have long been aware of the great importance of medical faith. These trials place its efficacy in a very conspicuous point of view and must even astonish persons who have particularly attended to this subject. They clearly prove what wonderful effects the passions of hope and faith, excited by mere imagination, can produce upon disease."
Perhaps Haygarth's patients were going to get better anyway. There's no way of being sure. But this was the beginning of something very important. Doctors thinking clearly around the impact of expectation and belief on health, what we would call the placebo effect. For a long time, the notion of studying this phenomenon was neglected, especially as the specific cures and magic bullets of modern medicine began to be discovered. But recently, there's been a resurgence of interest. Irving Kirsch, professor of psychology at the University of Hull, has been studying the placebo effect for many years, and he suspects that mental disorders like anxiety and depression may be particularly susceptible.
One thing is that they're mood disorders. They're disorders that involve a person's subjective feelings. Another, with depression in particular, one of the core features of depression is hopelessness. People who are depressed are feeling that they're in this terrible state of affairs and they feel hopeless about ever getting better. So when you offer them a treatment that provides a promise of relief, a promise of benefit, of making better this terrible state of affairs, that instills a sense of hope, which is exactly the opposite of what depression is.
What evidence is there to support that? Because it's quite difficult to measure the size of a placebo benefit, isn't it?
You measure it the same way as you measure the size of a drug benefit. There are studies in which people have been put on a waiting list and followed up while other people were given either a drug or psychotherapy or a placebo. And if you want to know what the size of the placebo effect is, you compare how much improvement there is in the group that's getting the placebo to how much improvement or change there is in the group that's not getting any treatment at all.
Now, Irving, you've done research comparing the benefits of some antidepressant drugs with placebo sugar pills.
Well, in those studies, we found that the major part of the benefit that you get from the drug is in fact due to the placebo component, to the knowledge that you're getting a drug. In other words, people get better when they're given antidepressants, but they also get better when they are given placebos, and the difference between the two in clinical terms is not all that great.
Some people might find that result disappointing. But in some respects, it's also quite an encouraging finding, paradoxically, because it shows that people do improve simply with placebos. It suggests, perhaps, that we all have untapped reserves of resilience. Physical pain is another area where the placebo effect seems to be powerful, and there's a long history of extraordinary stories. Dr. Henry Beecher was working in a World War II field hospital when the morphine ran out and found he could operate on horrible injuries using only injections of salt water. To better understand the placebo response to pain, Irving Kirsch has performed an ingenious experiment using a fake anaesthetic cream which he called Trivaricane.
What we did was to create pain by putting a metal bar on the index finger of the person's hand, and we did that on two fingers, on the left hand and on the right hand, and on one of those two fingers, we put this placebo ointment, Trivaricane, and the other we didn't. And so the placebo effect would be the difference in pain between the hand that got the treatment and the hand that did not. And what we have gotten in each of the studies that we have done is less pain when we've treated the finger with this placebo, Trivaricane, than when we have not.
And of course, Trivaricane was such a potent treatment that people needed to wear gloves when they were applying it.
Of course, and they had to have white medical coats and little badges saying that they were medical researchers, everything to make it believable, because the heart of the placebo effect is a person's belief and expectations.
In some respects, it's not so surprising that beliefs and expectations can change how we feel, reducing anxiety or depression or diminishing our perception of pain. But can the placebo effect produce objectively measurable changes, changes that we can actually see in the body?
We know that placebos that are given to asthmatic patients, you have them inhale from a placebo inhaler, can either produce bronchodilation or bronchoconstriction, depending on what you say the drug is going to do. We know that we can increase heart rate, we can increase blood pressure with placebo caffeine. So all of these are things that happen not just in the mind, but also in the body.
But perhaps even those intuitively are outcomes where it's not outrageous to imagine that positive expectations might have an effect. We're all fairly familiar with the idea that blood pressure and heart rate respond to our emotional states. We've all had a brisker heart rate before an exam or in response to bad news. But here's a particularly dramatic example. Cecilia Linder is Professor of Cardiology at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. She was part of a team investigating the use of pacemakers to treat a condition called obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a thickening of the muscle walls of the heart. Patients with this condition have difficulty pumping enough blood out to the body, and the symptoms include things like palpitations, chest pains, dizziness and dyspnea or shortness of breath. They were hoping that pacemakers would fool the heart into pumping more efficiently. Obviously, they wanted to test their proposed treatment against a placebo, a control group, to see if they worked any better. So in this case, some of the implanted pacemakers were switched off for 3 months, but without the patients knowing.
What we found was that we did have an overall positive effect by having the pacemaker turn on, both in terms of symptoms and quality of life. But what was surprising was that also during the 3 months when the pacemaker was actually turned off, we did see effect on chest pain, dyspnea, dizziness and palpitations. Those symptoms were significantly improved during inactive pacing. But even more surprising was that even the objective findings became better. The thickening of the heart became less during inactive pacing as well. So that means that there was a placebo both in terms of objective and subjective parameters.
In some respects, that's a completely outrageous finding. A pacemaker showing a benefit before it's even switched on. And like much of what we know about the placebo effect, it was almost an incidental finding, coming off the back of a trial looking at the effect of active pacemakers. So how could a pacemaker that switched off have such a measurable effect on the physiological functioning of the heart? This study didn't address that question, but Cecilia Linder speculates it might have something to do with a reduction in the hormones, known as catecholamines, that are related to stress.
We know that patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy are very susceptible to stress, and stress means outflow of catecholamines. And if those hormones get out in the circulation, that induces the heart to contract in a less favorable way. So if stress went down, that meant less stress hormones and a better heart work.
So we've seen how patients can experience dramatic benefits from a placebo as long as they believe that they're having a real treatment. But how about if it's the other way round? What if you're given a real physical treatment, but without your knowledge? Professor Fabrizio Benedetti from the University of Turin looked at just that, to establish how much of the response to a real drug is due to the placebo effect. Irving Kirsch.
He gives, in one case, morphine to patients intravenously, and sometimes he tells them when they're going to be getting the actual drug, and sometimes he doesn't. So sometimes they're getting morphine, and this is for postoperative pain, sometimes they're getting morphine knowing they're getting morphine, and sometimes they're getting morphine without knowing that they're getting morphine. And what he finds is that if patients don't know that they're getting morphine, it cuts the effect of the morphine in half. So about half of the effect of the real drug, in this case a powerful painkiller, morphine, appears to be a placebo effect.
So there's a placebo component to the benefit you get from real drugs like morphine, as well as from fake anesthetic creams or switched-off pacemakers. But to really unpick the factors behind a strong placebo response, the elegant thing to do is compare one placebo against another. This was done ingeniously by Professor Daniel Moorman, an anthropologist by training from the University of Michigan, with a special interest in medicine. He was looking at data from clinical trials of drugs to treat stomach ulcers. And because he was studying the placebo effect, he was only looking at the data from the control groups in these trials. That is, the people taking the inert, inactive, placebo sugar pills.
I had a suspicion that control group healing rates in these ulcer trials varied from place to place, and I didn't know what might have been causing that. And it occurred to me that I had these two groups of patients, all of whom had endoscopically diagnosed ulcers, all of whom took inert tablets for a month, some of them twice a day and some of them four times a day. And so I just looked at the outcome, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was the ones who had took two a day had an average of about 25% were healed by the end of the month, and the ones who took four a day, it was more like 36 or 38%. It was a statistically significant difference, and I think that just about anybody would consider that also to be a clinically significant difference.
So that's an extraordinary thing to have discovered, really. You found that four sugar pills a day clear ulcers better than two sugar pills a day.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, that's not the only study that's been done looking at the way a pill is presented.
There are a number of others. One of the nicest studies was one done in Britain. It was very large. It had 1,200 or 1,400 subjects. They were divided into four different groups. They were all women who said that they had headaches and that they treated them with over-the-counter analgesics, aspirin probably. And the four groups were comprised, two groups got aspirin and two groups got placebos. And one of the aspirin groups got aspirin that just said aspirin on it. The other aspirin group got aspirin tablets that had a very widely advertised brand name on it. The two control groups either got inert tablets labeled aspirin or inert tablets labeled with this famous brand name. And it turned out that the brand name aspirin worked better than the exact same aspirin without the brand name on it. And brand name placebo worked better than placebo without the brand name on it. The important thing to recognize that all of the patients who got aspirin got exactly the same aspirin. I mean, it was made by the same company in the same way, following, it just had different labels on it. So the thing is that it's not only the number of pills, but it's also what people know about the pills by watching the television.
It's a chastening finding for any skeptical scientist who's tried to persuade their friends that they're wasting money buying brand-name painkillers by arguing that they've got exactly the same molecules in them as supermarket-owned brand versions. Because actually, the believers are right. The drugs might be the same, but the expensive television ads actually make you feel better. And beyond the packaging, it even seems that something as simple as the colour of a pill can have an effect. Daniel Moorman again.
There was a study done some years ago in a medical school in the United States. Young medical students were told that they had been enrolled in a study of some new drugs being worked on by the pharmacology department. And each student was given either one or two pink or blue inert tablets. And what they told them was that one of the drugs being tested was a stimulant and the other one was a sort of a depressant, a sort of like a sleeping tablet. And the way it turned out was that the people who took red tablets felt sort of invigorated and up, whereas the people who took blue tablets felt sort of sleepy and logy. And there have been quite a few studies which have shown that red placebos or red pills tend to act as uppers and blues tend to act as downers.
But it would be wrong to get preoccupied with the idea of placebos as pills, because if they have no medicine in them, then the process of receiving and swallowing a pill is just symbolic, a ceremony or ritual like any other. Professor Ted Kapchuk from Harvard Medical School put this idea to the test. In an elegant study comparing two completely different forms of placebo, a pill and then a more elaborate pain-relieving ritual modelled on acupuncture.
What we did was take 270 patients with persistent arm pain, the kind of thing you see people who use computers taping their wrists with braces and stuff, and we gave half of them sham acupuncture needles. It looks like an acupuncture needle. It feels like an acupuncture needle. The patient sees it go in, but actually goes up the shaft. And then we gave the other half a sugar pill. We told them they may get real acupuncture or placebo acupuncture. They may get amitriptyline, which is an old-fashioned antidepressant that's sometimes used for pain relief, or placebo. But in fact, for the first 2 weeks, we only gave people dummy needle, dummy pill. And at the end of the study, the dummy needle significantly reduced pain compared to the dummy pill, meaning that just the appearance of one kind of medical ritual gives a different effect in the appearance of another medical ritual.
And the greater benefit, we might reasonably suppose, is because acupuncture feels like a more dramatic intervention than
a pill.
Well,
I think that's definitely one very clear possible interpretation. One of the nice things about that study is the sugar pill had a better effect than the acupuncture for sleep, meaning the ritual of taking a pill is probably better for sleeping. The ritual for pain relief is better with an acupuncture pin.
And is it reasonable to suppose that that's because we have different expectations about pills and about needles?
I think it's partly expectation, but I also think it's kind of an automaticness, maybe a conditioned response, where pills and sleeping and people who have insomnia often take sleeping pills, or that if you want to get rid of pain, a needle somehow is better. The other thing is that we know that animals have placebo effects, and that's not likely to be just cognitive expectation. There have been many experiments where rats are given sugar plus a drug and then later just given the drug. The sugar later on works like the drug. That's not an expectation. That's probably a conditioning response.
So in some respects, we might just be conditioning our bodies, responding to a pill like a cue, in the same way that Pavlov's dog salivated in response to the dinner bell. Very little is known in this area, but it's incredibly tempting to speculate about what might be going on inside the body and the mind when we experience symptom relief from a placebo. Anthony Jones is Professor of Neurorheumatology at Manchester University, and he's one of a growing band of researchers trying to understand what's happening when people respond to placebos in the treatment of pain.
People find it quite hard to grasp that this may be a real physiological phenomenon, because you can only judge someone else's pain by what they're telling you. So we did a study to try to show that this was a real phenomenon by using techniques where we look at the brain's response to a painful laser stimulus on the skin.
They used a fake anesthetic cream, a bit like Irving Kirsch's Trivaricane. And again, they found that patients reported a reduction in pain when they had the placebo. But they also found a difference in the activity of some of the brain areas involved in the perception of pain. Anthony Jones believes this might give some insight into how the placebo response to pain is working.
What we found is that most of the placebo response seems to be mediated by a change in how you anticipate the pain that might be coming along. And we think what happens is that there's, if you like, a hierarchy in the brain, and that when you get a pain stimulus, that's being transmitted to a number of levels in the brain, and a number of those will say, this is all nasty, this is potentially a threat and painful. But then there are some higher levels in the brain, particularly in the frontal cortex, in these forebrain areas, and they are telling these lower levels that actually this is not painful. And so the brain does, to an extent, decide about what you're going to experience.
It's always hard to be sure how to interpret this kind of brain imaging research, because so much is unknown about the normal functioning of the brain anyway. But there's one study which feels tantalisingly close to the holy grail of placebo research. A placebo that produces in the body the same physical effects as the actual drug it's substituting for. Parkinson's disease is a movement disorder caused by patients having reduced levels of the neurotransmitter dopamine in a part of the brain which helps to generate movement. Dr. Sarah Lidstone and colleagues at the University of British Columbia measured the dopamine response to Parkinson's drugs using a brain imaging technique called positron emission tomography, or PET. Once again, at the outset, their study wasn't focusing on the placebo response at all.
We were interested in looking at the brain's dopamine response to different doses of a common medication that's given for Parkinson's. In this case, it's called apomorphine. And so the patients were given three different doses of the medication. And as a control, we had one injection that instead of being the active medication was saline, it was a placebo. So what we did was we measured the dopamine levels using PET for each of these different doses of the medication and also for a placebo. And we weren't expecting to find any increases in dopamine on placebo because these subjects have Parkinson's and their brains are depleted of dopamine. And instead, what we actually found was that following placebo injection, the subjects released substantial amounts of dopamine in their brains without any medication having been given. And these are patients, as you remember, who are depleted in dopamine. So it was quite a major finding, actually. We were very surprised.
Even better, for some of the patients, not only did a placebo injection increase the amount of dopamine, but it also improved their symptoms.
In this particular study, all of the subjects released substantial amounts of dopamine. However, only half of the subjects who were studied reported actually feeling subjective benefit. And it was those patients who said that they felt better They said, you know, we feel much better. I feel like I have less stiffness in my joints. I can move faster. I feel more relaxed. It was those patients who said that they felt better who actually released higher levels of dopamine. So there was a link between their subjective perception of improvement in their symptoms and the amount of dopamine that was released in their brains.
By every possible measure of sense in the universe, this experimental result should be an outrage. An injection of nothing at all can induce a change in the brain which mirrors the effect of an injection of a proper anti-Parkinson's drug. But it's findings like these that require us to update our simplistic models of cause and effect in medicine. Placebos can relieve pain, relieve stress, even treat ulcers. Two sugar pills are better than one. Pink sugar pills are better stimulants than blue ones. Packaging enhances pain relief, and a dramatic placebo ritual is more effective than a quiet, humble sugar pill. None of this could have any pharmacological effect on the body. The question, of course, is where does the power lie? Dan Moorman.
The one thing that we can be absolutely sure of when we see somebody responding to a placebo is that it was not the placebo that did it. Placebos are inert. They don't do anything. But the fact remains that we see people taking placebos and we see they respond to them frequently. So what do we do? If it wasn't the placebo, what was it? And my argument is that the thing that is behind the effectiveness of these treatments is what the placebo means. It's the meaning of the drug. And the meaning of the drug is not just the pill. The treatment is the whole nine yards. It's the sign hanging on the wall showing you colon, you know, or the spine hanging from the doorknob at the chiropractor's office. It's the guy wearing the white coat. It's the stethoscope hanging out of the pocket. It's the diplomas hanging on the wall. You know, all of that stuff goes together to create this medical experience.
Medicine, of course, is an applied science. So there should be things we can take from this research into the placebo effect and exploit to improve medical practice. Perhaps we've neglected the ritual and the art of medicine in our excitement about molecules and magic bullets for individual diseases. Perhaps doctors, you might even argue, should be allowed to deceive their patients with sham operations and white lies about pills, anything if it helps the patient get better. Perhaps this could be a justification for alternative therapies as the acceptable face of placebo in the modern health marketplace. There are squabbles to be had, and even more improbable research, in the next programme.
Placebo was presented by Dr. Ben Goldacre. The readers were John Rowe, Chris Pavlo and Dan Starkey. The programme was produced by Matt Silver. In Holland, scientists are working on ways of creating meat from the stem cells of a pig.